Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriel Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In the late 1800s, a new piece of medical equipment made a big splash in Paris, an incubator to keep premature babies warm and to help them grow. But this new equipment didn't end up in hospitals at first. They weren't really interested or set up to try to help preemies. Instead, incubators attracted the interest of showmen and circus owners who thought that having these babies on display would net big bucks.
Bailey of Barnum & Bailey had an incubator sideshow in London. The London Royal Aquarium had a sideshow.
Desperate parents with no other options would hand over their tiny babies, and people paid good money to stare at them. It became a fad.
But over time, these showmen realized this was really a pain in the neck because it's a huge amount of work to keep preemies alive in incubators. This isn't a toaster oven. You need very, very skilled nursing, and you need round-the-clock care.
But one entrepreneur prevailed in this strange line of business. He called himself Dr. Martin Cooney, and he said he had a medical degree from Germany and extensive training, none of which was true.
He was really a showman through and through, but he was just decades ahead of the medical establishment.
Don Ruffel just wrote a book about him, The Strange Case of Dr. Cooney. Cooney set up sideshows in Atlantic City, at different world's fairs, at Coney Island.
Infants in incubators next to Under the Sea, which was the aquarium, and next to, in Chicago, the strippers, and next to the freak shows.
Cooney never charged his patients, but he made lots of money from all the visitors.
People couldn't believe a baby that small could be alive. So literally, sometimes he had to stop people from trying to poke their fingers into the machines because they thought the babies weren't real. They thought, oh, they must be wax babies.
But Cooney was really good at keeping these tiny babies alive. At the time, most American hospitals didn't treat preemies at all, so doctors would tell parents,
your child's only chance is to send it to this sideshow.
Cooney insisted the babies be fed with breast milk. He hired skilled nurses to watch over them. His facilities were meticulously clean. And inadvertently, these babies got even more of what they needed.
The nurses would take those babies out of the machines and show them off and, you know, hold them up.
Physical contact and touch, turns out, is crucial. Don says Cooney saved the lives of over 6,500 children. And his strange business had a major unintended consequence. It changed the attitudes of the American people and medical professionals that premature babies could and should be saved.
You know, there was a feeling in this country that these were weaklings, they might never grow up to be productive citizens. There was a eugenics movement in this country that really was very interested in only the survival of the fittest.
Cooney ended up working with medical professionals who brought his sideshow care for preemies to hospital wards. It helped lay the foundation of modern neonatal care. Our show today is about unintended consequences. What becomes of the things we didn't anticipate?
Were we possibly doing something that we didn't know we were doing? That's always on your mind.
With what she did, it expanded my world. It expanded what I understood myself to be capable of.
Literally a plague of rabbits on a denuded landscape as they've eaten every last thing in front of them.
The things we didn't see coming, the things we didn't set out to do, that's what we're looking at. After World War II, the most infamous surviving Nazis like Hermann Göring and Wilhelm Keitel were prosecuted by an international military tribunal at Nuremberg. Then followed a series of other trials conducted only by Americans. The first came to be known as the doctor's trial, because most of the 23 defendants were medical doctors. This trial took an unexpected turn, which had an unintended consequence. It resulted in an overhaul of medical ethics in the U.S. Jed Slayman has more.
One by one, their names are called, and they stand to face the judge.
Carl Brandt.
It's August 20th, 1947. A soldier gives each a set of headphones.
Found and adjudged you guilty of war crimes.
The judge is American, speaking in English while a German translation plays for the accused.
Military Tribunal 1 sentences you to death by hanging, and may God have mercy upon your soul.
Of the 23 defendants in the doctor's trial, 7 were hung, 9 others were imprisoned, and a final 7 were acquitted. These verdicts came after a real trial, with a prosecution and a defense. It wasn't just some kind of formality. The arguments mattered, especially because this trial was also meant as a message to a watching world, an antidote to Nazi ideology.
They are not ignorant men. Most of them are trained physicians. Yet these defendants, all of whom were fully able to comprehend the nature of their acts, and most of whom were exceptionally qualified to form a moral and professional judgment in this respect, are responsible for wholesale murder and unspeakably cruel torture.
That's U.S. General Telford Taylor of the prosecution.
The perverse thoughts and distorted concepts which brought about these savageries are not dead. They cannot be killed by force of arms.
The savageries he mentions were numerous and varied.
Experiments were conducted at the Buchenwald concentration camp to investigate the effect of various poisons upon human beings. The poisons
were People were exposed to extreme pressures and temperatures to test their limits. They were disfigured in experimental surgeries.
These burns were inflicted on experimental subjects with phosphorus matter taken from incendiary bombs.
But again, this was a real trial with a real defense team made up of German lawyers and doctors who had not participated in Nazi crimes. The Americans hoped simply to provide a fair trial, but a surprisingly cunning defense would blindside prosecutors with lasting consequences. The prosecution's first witness was Werner Leibrand, a German psychiatrist and medical historian. They wanted Leibrand to show how the Nazi doctors had violated Hippocratic ethics, do no harm. That golden rule of medicine clearly applied in doctors' offices, and the prosecution argued it also applied to medical research and experimentation. On cross-examination, the defense struck back. They asked Leibrand about malaria experiments carried out on U.S. prisoners in Illinois, where American doctors had infected healthy inmates as part of their research. They had done harm in pursuit of a greater scientific goal. According to the defense, that's what the Nazis were doing as well. They were trying to prove that this was the norm, that doctors could and routinely did harm their subjects in the course of research.
Leibrand, he was confronted with a question of doing experiment on prisoners, and he named a few countries that did experiment on prisoners, including the U.S., the United States, and condemned that forcefully. That was a witness for the prosecution, and I would say that the judges were surprised.
That's Evelyn Schuster, a medical ethicist and Nuremberg scholar. And here's what happened when the prosecution's next witness came up. It was Dr. Andrew Ivey. He was from Illinois and familiar with the malaria research.
He could not reconcile to what we do in research, that we do inflict harm intentionally to subjects to see if the hypothesis that I have, the scientific hypothesis, is working for us or it's not working. The drug is efficient or it's not efficient.
And while Ivy argued the Illinois inmates weren't forced, that they gave their permission, the defense's argument had shaken the judges. It was a mirror held to America's own medical research practices, and the judges didn't like what they saw. Suddenly, Hippocratic ideas, the basis of medical morality for centuries, were no longer enough.
We needed to give the subject equal power, that they cannot rely completely on doctor and their duty to do good.
When the American judges released the Nuremberg Code, what's become known as informed consent was the first point, and it's an entire paragraph, while the 9 others are mostly single lines. Subjects had to understand what was being done to them and why, with a complete picture of the risks and benefits. They had to know they had a choice in how they participated in studies, that they could withdraw from them. The code is considered a foundational aspect of medical research ethics today, but it didn't change American practices overnight. Think about the Tuskegee syphilis study, or the Philadelphia prison that acted as the personal lab of a dermatologist for 20 years before public outcry forced an end in the 70s. Evelyn Schuster says today, things have definitely improved, but researchers can still fall short, especially when treatment and research mix.
Form after form, first they give you like 50 pages of informed consent, and they say, okay, you read that and you sign here. You know, that's not informed consent.
She worries digitized consent, eked out across tablets and over Wi-Fi, will only make things worse, streamlining what should be a careful and cumbersome conversation between doctor and patient. Paul Windling is a medical historian at Oxford Brookes University in England, and he also questions whether modern researchers always live up to the original ideals of the code.
And although the patient might nod, the question is this really an enlightened consent? And I think it's very interesting that the Nuremberg doctors' trial, they didn't use the term informed consent, because informed consent is the doctor in a position of authority instructing the patient.
Evelyn has sat in on doctor-patient conversations to study these interactions, and she says what she witnessed did not seem like informed consent. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
You're listening to The Pulse, I'm Maiken Scott. Scientists trying to find new cures or ways to prevent diseases always have to think about unintended consequences. And a big part of their job is to test for and eliminate those unwanted outcomes.
Your heart is always in your throat. I mean, you're always worried that you may have caused something that could do harm.
That's Paul Offit. He is a pediatrician specializing in infectious disease and the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, which took 25 years to develop.
Before rotavirus vaccines were introduced routinely into the United States in the late 1990s, every child would get a rotavirus infection by 5 years of age. Everyone. It didn't matter the state of hygiene in the home, the state of sanitation in the country. Everyone would get a rotavirus infection. And that manifests itself primarily as a 6 to 24-month-old child who had fever, vomiting, and diarrhea in the winter. It's the winter vomiting diarrhea virus. We would see 400 children admitted to our hospital every year, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, with severe dehydration from this virus, which was basically the bane of my residency. We took care of a lot of children with dehydration because of this virus, and I saw a child die of this. And I think that when we were working on the vaccine at our hospital, that child's death was always in my mind.
Paul was motivated to find a way to stop this virus, but he was worried.
Me and my coworkers, as that vaccine got closer and closer to licensure, became obsessed with the notion that we might have been doing something that we didn't realize we were doing. I mean, was there anything about the viral vaccine that we were working with that might trigger an autoimmune response? Were there proteins, for example, on the surface of rotavirus that mimicked proteins, say, in the pancreas, that therefore one could cause diabetes, or mimicked proteins on the joint that could cause, you know, rheumatoid arthritis? Were we possibly doing something that we didn't know we were doing? That's always on your mind. And as Maurice Hilleman said, who I think is the father of modern vaccines, and that he made more than half of the vaccines that we currently use in the United States, he said, "I never breathe a sigh of relief until the first 3 million doses are out there." I mean, the fact is that we made those strains in our lab, and now they would be giving to millions, and then ultimately tens of millions, and now hundreds of millions of people. There's never like this moment of repose where you just relax and think, okay, I'm doing more good than harm. You're always worried.
So how is the testing, how does the testing process work?
You go slow. You start off in experimental animals trying to prove that you can induce an immune response, which at least appears to be protective in animals. And then you start with adults who you know have already been exposed to the virus and work your way down, you know, to adolescents who've been exposed, to children who've been exposed, ultimately to babies who haven't been exposed. And then you'd go from smaller trials to bigger trials to much bigger trials. I mean, for the rotavirus vaccine developed at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, that phase three trial, the final trial that was submitted for licensure, was a 70,000-person prospective, placebo-controlled, 11-country, four-year, roughly $350 million trial to prove that the vaccine was what you claim that it was, safe and effective. But again, that's 70,000 children, not 70 million children.
They had good reason to be cautious. Another rotavirus vaccine developed by a different team did have a negative outcome.
RotaShield vaccine, which was introduced into the market in 1998, was on the market for about 10 months, was found to be a very rare cause of something called intussusception, which is when your intestine sort of telescopes into itself, gets stuck, and can be a medical emergency. And there was certainly at least one child who died from that consequence, from that vaccine. And I think as a vaccine inventor, knowing that you could have done that just, you know, makes it very hard to live with that information.
So how do you do your work with that always looming over your head? I mean, it seems like it would be hard to focus on anything if you're constantly thinking, oh my gosh, what if, what if, what if?
Well, I saw a child die of rotavirus when I was a resident. But I remember having to walk out of the emergency department's treatment room, go into the waiting room and tell that mother that her child had died. And there is nothing worse than that. That stays with you forever and was a motivator for me in making this vaccine.
Paul Offit is a pediatrician and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We're talking about unintended consequences today on The Pulse. An alarm is supposed to alert us to something, right? Wake up! Or somebody's breaking in, something is on fire, something needs our immediate attention. Hospitals have tons of alarms. The machines monitoring patients or keeping them alive, they beep and buzz all day long. And those alarms have had an unintended consequence, one that some hospitals are trying to tackle. Katja Ritterbusch reports from Atlanta.
I'm walking along the winding hallways of Emory University Hospital in Atlanta with Ray Snyder. He's the head nurse at the Medical Intensive Care Unit here, one of six ICUs in the hospital. As we're passing the long row of patient rooms, Ray points to the different machines and monitors.
So that's an IV pump that's beeping in the background, as well as the patient's ventilator. So that's some of the other things that we get alarms from.
It's pretty quiet here now, as far as the beeping goes. But a few years ago, Emory's medical ICU had up to 1,400 alarms per bed per day. That's a lot, more than most nurses can handle. Across the entire hospital, it added up to tens of thousands of alarm sounds on one single day. And about 90% of them were false alarms. There wasn't a real problem. Eventually, the staff became desensitized. The alarms turned into background noise. And the urgent beeps, intended to let the staff know something was wrong, instead came to mean, it's probably fine. Pam Cosper is a critical care nurse at Emory.
We, you know, have had an incident that the alarm was going off and the nurse had just been in the patient's room, thought that it was a false alarm, and when she actually responded to the room, the patient was on the floor.
Alarm fatigue has had dire consequences. According to national data, several hundred patients died in recent years because of it. And that's probably just the tip of the iceberg.
We see this as a safety issue. It's not an issue of our annoyance. That's not it.
That's John Rogers. He's an ER doctor in Macon, Georgia, and president-elect of the American College of Emergency Physicians.
What it is we want to make sure that we don't miss an alarm that really needs to be responded to. But then again, we don't want to have so many false alarms that we ourselves become numb to them and kind of disregard them.
5 years ago, the Joint Commission, which is a quality control group for hospitals, put alarm fatigue on the top of the list of problems for hospitals to tackle. Since then, Emory's medical ICU has slashed the number of alarms from 1,400 to about 300 per bed per day. Still a lot, and the hospital is determined to lower it even further. One way to do this is to customize the monitor settings for individual patients. Take, for example, a 25-year-old competitive runner with a resting heart rate in the 40s. The machine's default setting is between 50 and 150, so it would constantly alert for low pulse. For the 70-year-old overweight patient, it may be a different story. But in the emergency department, customizing can be difficult, says John Rogers.
We don't have a lot of time to get to know people. We don't have a lot of their background information. We don't know what their kind of normal performance is, let's put it that way.
So another way to fight alarm fatigue is changing some of the alerts from audible to visual.
It was actually bedside nurses that suggested these large displays as a way to make better awareness within any ICU environment. And I kind of
That's nurse Pam Cosper, pointing to about a dozen screens around her. They make the nurse's station look like a control room.
I see it as just another way to be able to gain the nurse's attention as far as what's going on with their patient. They're interacting within the environment, walking around, so having those big screens is really a game changer.
There are also some basic things that help reduce false alarms, like frequently changing disposable electrodes and cleaning the patient's skin before placing the pads.
If after a short time that patient goes back into a normal
rhythm, head nurse Ray Snyder says they're also working on ways to use artificial intelligence to filter the data before the alarms start beeping.
The computers critically analyzing the data that's coming from all of the machines, not just the bedside monitor, and alerting the provider when there truly is something going on with the patient.
Nurse Pam Cosper likes all the new technology that has made the hospital a quieter place. But she says it doesn't replace the old-fashioned bedside check.
What we don't want is the nurse so focused on the technology that we lose sight that looking at that patient, laying eyeballs, is really critical. You can't just trust the machines.
Katya Ritterbusch reported this story from Atlanta. We're talking about unintended consequences, how we deal with the things we didn't see coming. Marta Rusick had been overweight for years, and her health and self-confidence were taking a hit. She went on a quest to change herself and her life. She managed to lose 80 pounds in 3 years, but she didn't anticipate the reactions she would get. Shai Binyakov caught up with Marta on a walk through Center City, Philadelphia.
And I usually walk very fast. I'll try to keep in mind that I'm with other people today.
No problem.
Physical activity is a daily thing for Marta now, but that's a somewhat recent change in her life. She struggled with her weight for years.
I started to get heavy about the time of high school. You know, you're surrounded by good things to eat. It's a crutch if something's not going well. It's a support if something is going really great. But by the time I got to college and, you know, now Marta, you're on your own, I had access to all this food.
Pizza, tacos, snacks, sweets, food was a reward and a crutch to get through tough times. Marta put on more pounds.
How did your weight, do you think, influence interactions that you had with other people?
My confidence took a pretty big hit. So as a consequence, I really didn't start dating until long after I'd gotten out of college. I'd always had guy friends and...
So Marta wasn't feeling great about herself. Plus...
I started to get a pain in my side, and we suspected that it might be kidney stones. And someone had said, you know, common causes of or common characteristics of somebody that has kidney stones, women usually get them. It's women over 40 and women who are overweight. So fat, female, 40. And I had two out of the three, which didn't bode well.
She never confirmed the kidney stones, but at 218 pounds, she knew something should change. It had to change.
I don't like working out.
Marta is also a lifelong asthma sufferer, which didn't help.
My mother would always say, you know, my daughter has asthma. She really shouldn't be engaged in physical activity. I don't want her to, you know, get overrun, and I don't want her to, you know, get overexcited.
But Marta, determined to do something about her weight, dusted off a recumbent bike from the basement, got on, and started pedaling. How do you feel, like, at the end of 15 minutes, that first... week or
so. I wanted to die that first day. It's just like my heart is like, why are you doing this to me? I thought we were friends.
Change came slowly, and Marta wasn't even the first to notice it.
Definitely other people were the ones to let me know, hey, there's something different here. And what's nice is in the beginning it was, are you doing okay? Are you sick? Is something wrong? They didn't realize, well, I've taken the initiative and decided that I don't want to be 218 pounds anymore.
So at first they asked if you were doing okay, mm-hmm. And then there were some more positive kinds of comments.
Oh, absolutely. hey, you look really good. Have you done something different with your hair? People were more free with the comments once they realized, oh, this isn't like a serious illness that's causing you to lose the weight. This was a definite choice. I think they felt more comfortable to say, well, in that case, oh my goodness, you look so good.
Marta joined a gym and started to up her effort. And as she did that, she started to get compliments.
Hey, you look really good.
So she put in more time and got noticed.
Have you done something different with your hair?
More effort, more compliments.
Oh my goodness, you look so good.
Marta took up spin, slowly at first, but she got better and better. Her asthma disappeared. She wasn't just losing weight. She was becoming an athlete.
There was definitely more muscle tone. I became a lot more flexible, which was great.
And at the same time that this was going on, you were changing your diet also.
Exactly.
Right.
Because you're only as good as the food that you're putting in.
So you were counting calories?
Yeah.
At this point, Marta was a completely different person from when she started. She was thin, buff, and flexible. She'd gone from a size 16 to...
I was pretty small. I think I was a size 4 at my smallest.
That's when things got weird. When do the catcalls start?
The catcalls started, you know, small enough. You know, I used to work for the Apple store, and, you know, the guys that were working around me, wow, she looks really good. Like, you'd overhear people, and you'd like, wow, she's changed a lot. But then it started to become catcalls, like people on the bus, people walking around the city.
Would you mind just kind of telling me some of the comments that you got from people?
Back that thing up, you know, looking good, baby, things of that nature. And, I like a teeny waist. Yeah, those are the milder ones. I've heard ones that I definitely wouldn't want to repeat on the airwaves.
How'd you feel? Like, how did that, you know, this is a very different kind of feedback than you were getting at first.
At first, you're kind of like, oh, wow, strangers on the street are telling me I look good. I must be doing something right. But as a feminist, you kind of wonder later on, well, what was wrong with me before? Was I not beautiful? Was I not worthy of your attention when I was 218 pounds? Because what was wrong with me before that, you know, when I got on a septa bus at 218 pounds, you know, you were happy to say, move your fat ass.
Eventually, Marta joined the Peace Corps and spent a year in the Gambia. There, food was about joy and community. But she realized that keeping a diet would be a challenge.
There's either a lot of bread, a lot of different grains, or there's a lot of rice. So that was tough because that was a huge way to build community, was to eat several meals a day with your family. If you were traveling, people would say, oh, come and eat with us. So, you know, I always had a spoon in my bag for those occasions so that I could just chow down wherever I went.
Her stay in Africa and her experiences there transformed Marta's relationship with food.
It wasn't just about, I'm going to splurge and have a slice of cheesecake. It was about, I'm going to go enjoy a meal with my friends. It was definitely more of a bonding experience. And it was a relationship that was transformed.
And her attitude toward fitness and her body has changed too. It's no longer about what other people say to her or think of her.
Last week when I was in North Carolina, I met a woman named Ruby. And she gave me this affirmation that she says, I want you to just say this to yourself at least once a day. You know, when you wake up in the morning, when you go to sleep at night. And she said, I want you to say, I am totally and absolutely in love with myself. And that's really what it's become about. There are always going to be people who say, you're not good enough, or you could have taken that further. You could have put in 15 more minutes of working out. But it really doesn't matter. I don't answer to any of those people. At the end of the day, it's about I am totally and unbelievably in love with myself.
That story was reported by Shaiben Yaakov. We're talking about unintended consequences on the Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Like many cities around the world, Chicago is replacing a lot of its old street lights with bright white LEDs. These modern lights use a lot less wattage, and that can save cities millions on electric bills. Plus, Chicago leaders are touting the bright lights as crime busters. But those leaders are also facing pushback because of some unexpected side effects. These bright LEDs produce a good bit of light in the blue spectrum, and the crux of the fight is just how bright and blue the Chicago lamps should be. Monica Eng spoke with a newly minted activist.
J.J. Nauchi is a Chicago sixth grader, and he's so concerned about the city's new LED streetlights, he called and talked to the mayor about them. But then he never heard back. So he brought his problem to me at Curious City. It's a show where we answer listener questions at WBEZ Radio in Chicago.
I love astronomy because of the stars, most of all. And the LEDs they're putting in are going to block the stars so that no one at all can see them.
But when it comes to LEDs, JJ is concerned about a lot more than just stargazing. He's also worried that their intense blue light spectrum can cause a bunch of problems.
First of all, there's glare, how it affects wildlife, how it affects human health.
And last of all, he says,
bright light does not stop crime. It actually increases it.
So could all this really be true? Well, the science on LEDs these days is moving at the speed of, well, really fast. They're getting more efficient all the time. But new research is also showing some bad side effects from the blue light the bright ones emit. So we tracked down top international researchers to see if JJ's concerns really held up. And we're going to take them one by one. Okay, JJ's first concern, light pollution. That's excess light that makes it hard to see the stars. JJ thinks Chicago's bright blue LEDs will make the situation worse. And indeed, Italian researcher Fabio Falchi says it's already pretty bad.
80% of North Americans, for example, cannot see any more the Milky Way from where they live. And these are the first generation that arrives without the possibility to see the Milky Way and the stars.
So could the less blue LEDs JJ wants really help the issue? Canadian physicist Martin Obey says you bet. In fact, he estimates they could improve night sky viewing in Chicago by as much as half. Point one for JJ. Okay, now to JJ's second beef about the current lights. Danger to wildlife. Yeah, a lot of studies have shown how nighttime LEDs confuse nocturnal animals, triggering a range of behavior and migration changes. Travis Longcore boiled it down in a recent paper. He's at the University of Southern California, where he studies something called urban landscape ecology. His main recommendation is less blue light.
Basically chopping off the blue end of the spectrum intentionally to avoid those areas of the spectrum that have the most deleterious consequences to things that we as a society care about.
JJ's next concern is about glare. See, blue light has shorter wavelengths, which can look fuzzy to the older eye. In fact, even scientists who generally defend current LED streetlights are down on the glare part. Here's Mariana Figuero. She's a lighting researcher at Rensselaer Polytechnic in New York State.
You know, that's one of the things about the LEDs that I see problems with. They're awfully glary, and it's very uncomfortable. So I think shielding is important.
And those shields, they're something Chicago lights still don't have. They're kind of like flaps on the side of the lights that keep it from shining up in the sky or into your bedroom where it might cause health problems. Here's the theory. Blue light can suppress melatonin levels. Melatonin's a hormone that helps regulate sleep and even treat cancer. So folks are concerned that too much nighttime blue light could trigger more sleep disorders and other problems. But the science? Well, two recent studies from Harvard and Spanish researchers link bright outdoor light and specifically LED lights with increased breast and prostate cancer. And suppressed melatonin from the light is thought to be at play. But
these are association studies. They don't prove cause and effect.
That's Tulane oncology professor David Blask. And he's not discounting all the blue light we get from our phones and tablets at night.
But there seems to be a significant, important outdoor component to this.
Finally, Chicago is pushing bright LEDs as crime busters. But JJ's got some anecdotal evidence that this may not work out that way. See, there was this incident at his grade school recently
where one kid got into a fight with another kid, but he was telling us how it was because he didn't get a good night's sleep last night. He went to bed at approximately 11 o'clock. When people my age, 9 to 13, are supposed to have 10 to 11 hours of sleep.
Okay, it's not clear that a bunch of grown-ups are going to start acting like that sleepy sixth grader. But JJ may still have a point. That's because most research shows that reported crime actually stays the same or rises with bright new lights. Researchers think maybe thieves can spot valuables in a car more easily under bright lights. Despite all this evidence, JJ hasn't heard a thing about changes to Chicago's LED rollout. But he has heard that the city's been shopping around and even talking to makers of new, less blue LEDs, complete with shields and a shape to reduce light pollution. And JJ thinks he might have played a role.
It makes me feel very hopeful. The only thing we can do right now is cross our fingers.
That story was reported by Monica Eng. When humans discover a new place, they sometimes end up changing what was there in dramatic ways. That happened on Macquarie Island. It's a tiny, remote speck of land between New Zealand and Antarctica. It belongs to Tasmania, which is part of Australia.
And it's affectionately known as Macca, or the Great Green Sponge. It's as green you can imagine.
Nick Holmes is a conservation biologist, and he says seafarers showed up on Macquarie Island in the early 1800s to hunt seals and penguins for pelts and oil. Here's what Nick says it looked like before people arrived.
It would have been an incredibly noisy, smelly, rich, green environment that would just be wall to wall with penguins and elephant seals and fur seals. It would have been like in a busy London Underground subway. There would have been just bodies constantly moving shoulder to shoulder and a deafening noise of whistling and calling. And then as you move up into the slopes, you'll start to get a really special kind of seabird. And there would have been more than a dozen species of these burrowing petrels, and the burrowing petrels and prions. And they're flying around making all these amazing calls, and so that's what you get amongst this rich green carpet of Macquarie Island, is these dense smells of the ocean and these bizarre sounds like you're in some kind of rave discotheque.
Wow. So here's this island with its beautiful landscape and all this animal life, and then in come seafarers. And they bring new creatures to this island. What did they bring, and what happens next?
When these people come to the islands, they bring animals with them, accidentally and on purpose. And the animals that they bring on purpose will include things like cats. There were rabbits. And then there's accidental introductions, and in this case, it was rats. And these cats were brought along probably to help keep rats down on the ship, but also for company at night. But these cats weren't kept indoors. They were let go on the island, and they soon discovered these millions of seabirds that were up in the slopes. And the rabbits very quickly, the rabbits were brought to the island as food, as sort of an insurance strategy for those people on the island, because it was a familiar food to them.
So at first, which creatures did best on the island? The rats, the cats, the rabbits? How did they impact what was there, and how did they fight each other?
So the sequence of the animals that were brought to the island, we know that cats were documented very early with some of the first human arrivals, and these cats would have made very fast work of animals native to the island. We know from estimates in the early 1980s that cats were predating, so hunting and killing and eating, more than 60,000 seabirds a year. And very quickly, more than 10 seabird species went into decline and were extirpated from the island. We also know that rats consume seabirds. Rats will eat invertebrates. They're remarkably efficient and will consume a variety of things on the island, and that can have devastating consequences to the system itself. It starts to be disrupted. Rabbits would have consumed the vegetation, and these islands, the vegetation on the islands, like the seabirds, evolved in the absence of these kinds of herbivores and these kinds of predators, and so there was no natural defense.
By the 1950s, scientists became worried that the island would be forever changed if nobody stepped in. They tried different things with varying results, but in the 1990s, the governments of New Zealand and Tasmania ended up waging an all-out war against the cats on the island, and they eradicated them.
And almost immediately, they started to see some of that change. There was some species like the Cape petrel and the grey petrel, which very quickly turned up on the main island in places that people knew well and knew that in recent history there was no evidence of them being there. And so the removal of this predator had an immediate effect. And in 2011, just 10 short years after the removal of cats, the resources and the technology and the political will all came together to remove and completely eradicate rabbits, rats, and mice from the island. They completed that job successfully, and now there are no more cats, there are no more rats, rabbits, or mice on the island. And so those unintended consequences of the sealers arriving on the island from so long ago, they'd all come to a halt.
What are some of the lessons that your scientific community has learned from all that has happened on this island?
We can't turn back the time and go back and tell these sealers that introducing the cats was a terrible idea that will lead to all these devastating consequences. But some of the lessons learned are to have hope and to be brave, that there are opportunities to help some of these native species return back to their original locations and to support what once was. And what happened on Macquarie Island, to be able to successfully eradicate cats, rats, rabbits, and mice has also been replicated on islands around the world. There's been more than 1,200 different attempts to do similar things with invasive mammals on islands around the world. And the success rate is about 85%. And so the lesson from Macquarie Island is to have hope and be brave that we can help make a difference. Will it go exactly as we predict? Maybe not. But let's put the best of what we have together and see if we can't help make this world a better place.
Nick Holmes is Director of Science at Island Conservation. That's a nonprofit organization working to prevent extinctions. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We've been talking about unintended consequences in nature, in medicine, and in our lives. Ariel Johnson owns a comic book store in Philadelphia. It's called Amalgam. She was the first female black comic store owner on the East Coast, and she's been wildly successful. Marvel even put her likeness on the cover of a comic book. Ariel was able to start this store in part thanks to her mom and the money her mom left her after she died. It was a life-changing gift and definitely something Ariel didn't see coming. She'd always had a difficult relationship with her mother. She says her mother didn't get her, and she didn't really get her mom. And then when her mom got sick and Ariel became a caregiver, things got even more complicated. She told us the story of her mother's illness and the beginning of Amalgam right in her comic book store.
When my mom had the stroke, it was a long road of like deterioration. She had the stroke when I was in college, and slowly, you know, it was kind of just watching the decline for like about 8 years. You know, in the midst of that, it was harder on our relationship. So as I got older, the canyon between us got wider. So her getting sick and needing as much care as she did was just hard. It was hard on her, it was hard on me, it was hard. And so because of that, we bumped heads even more, because now we're in a place where she actually needs. It's not just like, oh, mom. It's like, no, she needs you. She needs you to do this. She needs you to do that. And I think about, you know, things that would usually spin into an argument, but it was us trying to show the other one that we loved each other. Because she used to, you know, in the midst of me trying to help her get her shoes on or trying to get in a wheelchair so we can go to church, she would say things like, you look really pretty today. But I'm in the middle of half picking you up to get you in this chair, so can we focus on helping me so that we don't both end up in this floor instead of telling me that you think I'm pretty? Because in my mind, it's like, what does that matter? It's like, you know, we have something to do. But it's like, she was telling me she loved me. You know, she liked to hear like how pretty she looked, or oh, I like your this and I like your that. And I didn't do that with her, because it's because I'm helping you brush your teeth, and I'm, you know, helping you in the bathtub. You know what I mean? And I'm, for her, I wasn't showing her I loved her because I didn't say those things. But it's like, but I'm here and I'm doing the work, you know. And yeah, that person at church said you look pretty, but that person at church is not coming home with us to do the hard stuff. On my mom's passing, my sister and I found out about the provisions that she had made for us. I didn't expect it But I wasn't surprised because I know my mom. So again, it's not one of those things you're actively thinking about, like, did mommy take out an insurance policy? But knowing how my mom was, I wasn't surprised. You know, the money that mommy left, you know, was really the foundation for Amalgam, but not because that money was used directly to open Amalgam, but just because it helped me to take things off the table. So, you know, after that, I was able to pay off all three of my student loans. I was able to pay off both of my credit card bills. I was able to pay off my car, and I was able to take a 30th birthday trip to Europe. So all of that just took stuff off the table so that I could see things more clearly, and also allowed me to understand the idea of a larger world. You know, when you're poor, your world is your block or your very close-knit community of the few places that you frequent, but you don't understand that how much bigger that the world is because your world seems so small. And so with what she did, it expanded my world. It expanded how I thought about things. It expanded what I understood myself to be capable of. You know, that there is more out there than I even understand. It was like the first step in me being, I think, brave enough to do something unknown.
Last year, Ariel got a beautiful gift. It's a comic book about her origin story, how she fell in love with comics as a kid and then came to own the store. And one of the pages featured in the book made Ariel cry.
I'm sitting in the chair reading a comic book in the picture, and behind me is like the spirit of my mom with just her hands on my shoulders, kind of smiling down at me. And it was just really touching because, again, she is the cornerstone of it, because without the provisions that she did and the values that she instilled in me, this would not have been a thing.
Ariel Johnson is the owner of Amalgam Comics and Coffee House in Philadelphia. Len Webb produced this story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our intern is Mike Moscarelli. Our health and science reporters are Irina Zhurov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. This week, we have to say goodbye to Alana Gordon, who is leaving us to be part of a prestigious fellowship for science reporters at MIT. Alana brought us some wonderful stories, from the history of Legionnaires' disease to the tale of One-Eyed Joe.
And the scene of the crime, if you could call it that. Eastern State Penitentiary.
We could always count on Alana for great moments and surprising turns, and we'll miss her, and we wish her the best. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Alex Stern is our associate producer, Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
Supporting The Pulse, the Coriell Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriell.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.